Islamic Republic of Iran is an important economic partner for Iraq, and it's astute with Iraq and its war against terrorism and against Daesh. There are historic, cultural, and religious ties deeply rooted in the history of the two countries. How can these ties be improved for it to reach the needed stage, and how can all the obstacles facing these ties be removed?
I believe our relationship with the Islamic Republic of Iran has reached a very good stage, and consultations are continuous, if not daily, then on a weekly basis, in all sectors, trade, business, security, and even in some cases on the diplomatic level. All these issues are there. The two countries, Iraq and the Islamic Republic of Iran, have been proactive in reaching agreements which would be to the interest of both republics.
Is there any side that opposes this partnership or strengthening these relations between Tehran and Baghdad? Iraq is honestly under pressure to diminish these ties.
Honestly, so far, no one has put any pressure on me or the government of Iraq not to take these steps. However, we do take into account very seriously, and our policy also is to take into account the interest of both countries and cooperation in sectors where there is an interest for both countries for the sake of mutual cooperation and mutual interest.
After the budget was ratified by the Iraqi parliament, there continues to be controversy over this budget. The government has also appealed concerning certain articles in the budget. What is the position of the presidency and the president in light of this controversy, and how will you sign this budget after it was ratified, and how will it affect the situation as a whole in Iraq?
First of all, having a budget is necessary for any country in order for it to implement its programs and pay the salaries of the workers. That is one part of the budget. Another point is that there is always, in all countries, especially if it is a democratic country, there is also debate over the budget. There's no budget plan in any country which is complete and 100% accepted by the cabinet, the parliament, and even groups outside of parliament. I personally, in the name of the presidency, have signed the budget, and God willing, we will begin implementation in days from now. There is no problem in this regard. The most important issue in this debate is the implementation of the budget plan. But we have begun implementation of the cabinet's program when it comes to services and improving the infrastructure of Iraq, and that is the most important thing for the people of Iraq.
The relationship between Kurdistan of Iraq and the central government has not always been at its best. There were times of differences and, in some cases, lack of trust. What is the position of the president from these differences, and how is your relationship with the Kurdish Democratic Party? Also, there are internal differences between the two major Kurdish parties. Some fear that this threatens the unity of Kurdistan and could lead to separation of the region of Kurdistan into two parts, I mean Erbil and Soleimaniye. How do you look at all this?
First, the relationship between the region and the center is good. True, in some cases there are varying viewpoints, different demands, and this is necessary. And we declare it, and meetings between both sides are continuous. And now we have also agreed to the budget of the region of Kurdistan, and there is an agreement on importation of petrol and on the income of Kurdistan. All this is there. Relations between political parties, everyone knows, no two parties see eye to eye. Not all parties have the same ideology. Of course, there are differences between the Kurdish parties, as there are differences between the Iraqi political parties, and this is needed. Legitimate competition between political parties, I believe, is for the interests of society. But looking at differences as deep divisions, which would lead to separation, is a bit exaggerated. And a group of people don't understand what the situation is in reality. We are working for the sake of coordination and cooperation and to serve the Iraqi society in the current circumstances. And cooperation between the Kurdish region and the center continues daily. I am not far from the situation. I am in contact daily and continuously to strengthen the relations and improve relations to implement the program of the region as well as the program of the central government.
In your opinion, Mr. President, will this government continue for 4 years, or will we perhaps witness early elections? What would occur of the agreements between the factions while forming the cabinet? Can we say that the situation is at its best since 2003, meaning your relations with Mr. Sudani and the government in general?
The relationship between the government and the presidency, and even with the parliament and among the parliamentary blocs in general, is very good. Our efforts now are focused on implementing the program of the cabinet, especially after the approval of the budget plan, in order to give services and improve the infrastructure in Iraq and to become self-sufficient in some areas which are necessary, such as the issue of nutrition, health, and even water. We are working on these aspects, and our hope is that we can improve these sectors, which are a priority in our program. And the change of the cabinet is one of the priorities. We are working on the current plan for the government and hope to implement the plan in the near future. And 4 years is not a very long time in the age of any people. It is the parliament that decides when the elections would take place, and the government decides when there will be elections, or the president would decide when we are in need of holding new elections.
As the main protector of the Constitution, there are calls which we hear every now and then on the need to amend the Constitution of Iraq, since it is said that it's static and that some points are missing, issues which are supposed to be in the Constitution. Some saw this in the issue of the formation of the cabinet, which took more than a year.
The issue of the Constitution did not have anything to do with the formation of the cabinet.
Well, how does the President see the issue of amending the Constitution? Do you see that it is necessary, or perhaps this can be postponed?
First of all, my answer is that there is no constitution in the world which implements all the points related to the needs of society. In some countries, there is no constitution at all. Therefore, now we are implementing the constitution of Iraq, and until now, there has not been any opposition to the constitution from any side in Iraq. True, we might need some changes or switching some terms for other words. For example, in the beginning, when we approved the Constitution, we had the Presidential Committee for the country, the President and two Vice Presidents that form one committee. Now we have a President of the Republic, and there are several other issues which are noted. In my opinion, these issues are, for the time being, secondary issues. Now our focus is on strengthening security and stability, as well as implementing the program of the cabinet. After all, if we have some problems in the Constitution or the law or legislation, we will have time to think about them and to work on it based on our Constitution or based on our current laws.
The system of governance presently in Iraq is parliamentary, based on the parliament. But there are some calls demanding that change to a presidential system of governance. Considering the current circumstances, can such a system be implemented? What are the components that would oppose a presidential system, and what's your position?
على التحول الى النظام الرئاسي ما هو موقفكم
In the current situation, I don't think this is applicable. Maybe one individual here or there is calling for such an issue, but for now, our focus is on what I have said. Implementing the Iraqi constitution and the current legislation, in addition to the current program put forth by the government.
How are the ties between Baghdad and Washington during the current government? Do you have a plan to visit Washington? In general, how are relations between you and the U.S.?
Relations are good with Washington and the Americans. It is not something we hide. We have good relations and there is cooperation. And we have visits to Washington at the level of officials and delegations depending on the need and necessity. But the most important thing I want to focus on is that we preserve and defend the independence of Iraq on all levels.
Your option for today and a better tomorrow. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
In Britain, Prime Minister Rishi Sunak faces a fresh conflict of interest row over trade talks between London and New Delhi. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The British newspaper The Observer has covered this story. With a general election not far away and the economy still struggling, Rishi Sunak is on the hunt for good news. Next month, he will be in New Delhi, India for the G20 summit, a visit that will be unusually rich with picture opportunities and chances to strike deals. Sunak's parents are of Indian Punjabi descent, and his wife, Akshata Murthy, is a hugely wealthy Indian businesswoman, fashion designer and venture capitalist. In many ways, it will be a homecoming for the first Asian couple ever to occupy No. 10 Downing Street. Sunak's business and trade secretary, Kemi Badenoch, has been in India over the past few days, laying the ground for a string of announcements with her G20 counterparts. Inevitably, much of the talk in the United Kingdom and Indian diplomatic business and trade circles has been about the possibility of a post-Brexit trade deal between the United Kingdom and India. The two governments had hoped to conclude one last autumn, but negotiations have dragged on. Agreement between the world's fifth and sixth biggest economies, India and the UK respectively, to reduce tariffs on UK exports such as cars, and increase still further access for Indian workers to the United Kingdom would be a big deal for Prime Minister Sunak. But there are issues worrying Downing Street. India already tops the list of nations sending citizens to the United Kingdom. Between June of last year and June of this year, the number of Indian healthcare workers entering the United Kingdom leapt by 81%. From 18,570 to 33,669. Indians also topped other categories. While Brexiters in Sunak's party desperately want evidence that global Britain is real, they may not be thrilled to see that the flip side of liberated post-European Union trading arrangements means replacing EU workers with others from further afield. There is, though, another fear nagging away inside Number 10 and a Foreign Office. In return for lowering tariffs on British exports to Indian markets, New Delhi is asking for more visas for skilled workers such as IT professionals who work for Indian technology companies that have invested in Britain. India also wants improved access for young Indians to the United Kingdom. One of the main companies with an interest in securing more temporary visas to the United Kingdom is Infosys, the huge global leader in digital services and consulting co-founded by Akshata Murthy's father, N.R. Narayana Murthy. Although Akshata has only a 0.93% holding in the company, it's still worth £481 million and accounted for the vast majority of the Sunak family's wealth when the Sunday Times published its 2023 Rich List in May. Shivendra Singh, Vice President and Head of Global Trade at NASSCOM, the IT industry body, said new age technologies such as generative artificial intelligence, blockchain and machine learning have widened the demand-supply gap. We want to make it easier for IT workers to go to Britain to fill the gap on projects and then come back. They will go and return. This does not affect net migration at all. Infosys applied for 2,500 visas for the UK in 2019, primarily so that it could bring its staff to work on large outsourced IT contracts in the country. Being such a large enterprise, the company has the ear of the Indian government. The problem for Prime Minister Sunak is that a UK-India trade deal, if struck, is likely to be of considerable financial benefit to the company in which his own wife already has a very large financial stake. Questions about a conflict of interest are already being asked. What should the Sunaks do? That is what Number 10 has worried about for some time, according to one source aware of thinking at the top of government on this issue. There's a lot of concern about perception and what it would look like to people, a worry that one day someone will eventually join the dots. The Indian website The Wire has also covered the same story. Britain's Prime Minister Rishi Sunak may be facing more troubles over his wife's connection with IT giant Infosys, with calls for transparency over his interests as the free trade deal with India looks at increasing visas for Indian workers, according to the British newspaper The Observer, reporting on Saturday, 26th of August. Rishi Sunak faces a new conflict of interest row before a G20 summit in New Delhi next month over claims that his family could stand to benefit financially from a post-Brexit trade deal that he's negotiating with India. Lawmakers and trade experts say there are concerns at the highest levels of government over potential transparency issues relating to his wife, Akshata Murthy's shareholding in Infosys. Akshata Murthy is the daughter of one of Infosys's founders, Narayana Murthy. The opposition head of the Parliamentary Select Committee on Business and Trade, Darren Jones, told The Observer that it was important for the Prime Minister to declare his interests. Darren Jones said, "I expect him to do so in respect of the India trade deal as well." The Shadow Trade Secretary, Nick Thomas-Symonds, said his party backed a trade deal with India, so it is important that Prime Minister Sunak is transparent about any relevant business links and his personal role in negotiations. In a statement to The Observer, a British government spokesperson said that the Prime Minister was pursuing a trade deal with India in the best interests of the United Kingdom. The Prime Minister's interests have been declared in accordance with the normal processes. The latest accusation follows last week's announcement that the British Parliament's standards watchdog had concluded that Sunak had breached the code of conduct, albeit unintentionally. He was admonished for failing to properly declare his wife's shareholdings in a childcare company that stood to benefit from new government policies. Akshata Murthy was at the centre of another controversy last year due to her non-domicile status in Britain, which excludes her from paying British taxes on overseas income. She subsequently consented to pay taxes on her foreign earnings going forward. The British Prime Minister will be travelling to New Delhi to attend the G20 summit next month, where he is expected to discuss the free trade deal talks in a bilateral meeting with the host, Prime Minister Narendra Modi. The aftermath of Brexit prompted Britain to pursue new global trade relationships, and a significant focus was directed towards forging a comprehensive trade pact with India. A crucial requirement put forth by India during the negotiations for a free trade agreement is the expansion of visas granted to its workforce in sectors like information technology and artificial intelligence.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Tensions between Niamey and Paris are running high as Niger's military leaders have given the French ambassadors 48 hours to leave the country. In a statement, Niger's foreign minister said the decision to expel the French ambassador was taken partly due to their refusal to respond to an invitation to a meeting with Niger's Minister of Foreign Affairs. The statement added that actions by the French government have been contrary to the interests of the African nation. This prompted a response from France. Paris dismissed the ultimatum, saying Niger's junta have no authority to ask its ambassador to leave. The ultimatum was widely supported by Niger's public. Hundreds of protesters gathered in front of the French military base in Niamey on Friday, calling for the departure of foreign troops.
It's all part of the general mobilization we have here. It's to demand the departure of these invading forces, this occupying force, the French force here at Niamey Air Base. That's why we want to come to the door of this base to ask them to leave our country from here. We don't need this occupying force. We don't want them on our land.
The latest development in Niger comes amid a series of anti-French demonstrations in the African country after the army overthrew President Mohamed Bazoum in July. The military leaders in Niamey accused former colonial power France of seeking to use force in order to reinstate the ousted president. They also said the Economic Community of West African States, ECOWAS, is an organization in the pocket of France. This is because ECOWAS has imposed tough economic sanctions on Niger following the coup and has threatened the country with military intervention.
The region is employing other elements of its instruments and engaging with the military authorities. We are hopeful that these diplomatic efforts will yield the desired outcome and make it unnecessary for the deployment of the force. Nonetheless, preparations continue towards making the force ready for deployment.
The anger and resentment against ECOWAS and its threats to use military force against junta leaders in Niger comes as many across the Sahelian nation blame France for pushing the West African bloc to use military force in Niger. The question, indeed, is that where is all that hatred against France coming from? Over the years, Niger has faced growing insecurity amid the worsening effects of political instability and armed insurgencies. At the same time, the West African nation, a resource-rich country of 26 million, is, according to UN figures, considered one of the poorest nations on Earth. Given that the French have been playing a crucial role in Niger, both politically and economically, the general public there points its finger at Paris to be the cause of all those grievances. But Niger is not the only country facing growing anti-French sentiment. The hatred against France has been a common feeling amongst many African countries, given that the military takeover in Niger is the sixth in the Sahel region in less than 3 years, coming after Burkina Faso, Guinea, and Mali. The toppling of President Bazoum has, in a way, created shockwaves not only across the sub-region, but reverberated across Europe and the United States. That's mainly due to the fact that Niger is home to strategic mineral reserves such as uranium, gold, and crude oil, among others. France holds mineral rights for the mining of uranium, which powers its nuclear power plant. This has made Paris highly depend on Niger's uranium mines. But being aware of the strategic importance of uranium to France's energy needs, Niger military leaders have already announced that they will suspend the export of uranium and gold to France and the US. The move is widely seen by many across Niger as a way to cut the hands of powers that have long been plundering the country's resources. Knowing that the same fate will be waiting for many across the Sahelian countries, African people are waking up to the fact that Western powers, namely France and the United States, have been maintaining their presence in their countries merely to plunder their resources. That's maybe the reason for Nigerians and other West African countries to come to the fact that the era of colonialism is over and they're the ones who should put an end to decades of West's occupation and economic exploitation of their countries.
In an interview, far-right Israeli Minister Itamar Ben-Gvir said that the right to life and movement for settlers in illegal settlements in the occupied West Bank trumped the right to movement for Palestinians. Palestinians have long railed against travel restrictions, including checkpoints imposed on them by Israel in the occupied West Bank. Ben-Gvir, who lives in the Jewish settlement of Kiryat Arba, near the flashpoint West Bank city of Al-Khalil, said in the interview the curbs were needed to protect his family's security.
My right, my wife's right, my children's right to move on the roads of Judea and Samaria are more important than the right of movement for Arabs. This is the truth. My right to life tops their right to movement.
The international community, along with the Palestinians, consider settlement construction illegal. More than 700,000 Israelis live in the occupied West Bank and East Al-Quds. Following Ben-Gvir's comments, the Palestinian Ministry of Foreign Affairs condemned his remarks as racist and heinous and said it only confirms Israel's apartheid regime of Jewish supremacy. Remarks by Ben-Gvir, who has a history of anti-Arab incitement and has long taken a hardline approach to the Palestinians, infuriated some legislators in the Israeli parliament. Arab lawmaker Ahmad Tibi strongly denounced Ben-Gvir, who oversees the police, for his provocative comments.
For the first time, an Israeli minister admits on air that Israel enforces an apartheid regime based on Jewish supremacy.
Karine El-Harar, a lawmaker from the opposition and a former minister, also reacted to Ben-Gvir's provocative remarks, blasting him as the authentic representative of the most racist cabinet Israel has ever had. The Rome Statute of the International Criminal Court defines apartheid, which is a direct symptom of military occupation, as a crime against humanity, characterized by the commission of inhumane acts such as unlawful killing, torture, and forcible transfer, which are committed to maintain an institutionalized regime of systematic oppression and domination by one racial group over another. Major human rights groups and UN officials have accused Tel Aviv of perpetuating such a system against Palestinians on top of the military occupation of their land and a decades-long campaign of genocide. Ben-Gvir, a member of Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's far-right coalition, has been convicted in the past of inciting racism and of supporting a terrorist organization. More recently, Ben-Gvir has said Israel must kill thousands of Palestinians, called for flattening buildings in the occupied West Bank, and has led multiple raids into Al-Aqsa Mosque. The West Bank has been rocked by violence since early last year, especially with repeated deadly raids by the Israeli army. Israeli forces launch raids on various cities of the West Bank almost on a daily basis under the pretext of detaining what the regime calls wanted Palestinians. The raids usually lead to violent confrontations with residents. Settler attacks against Palestinians and their property are also a regular occurrence. Palestinians in Al-Khalil are particularly vulnerable to settler violence as well as Israeli surveillance. A former Israeli army general has blamed the rising wave of violence in the occupied West Bank on settlers who, as he described, go very wild in terms of provoking the local population, doing terrible acts of vandalism, sometimes terrorism against Palestinian families. The former head of the Israeli Army's Operations Directorate, Israel Ziv, said Israeli settlers are definitely encouraged by what they think is the policy of the Israeli cabinet and the coalition today. The development came after a wave of recent resistance operations in the occupied West Bank. Against the decades-long occupation by the regime, more than 200 Palestinians have been killed this year in the occupied Palestinian territories in Gaza, the highest number of fatalities since 2005. The majority of these fatalities have been recorded in the West Bank. At least 30 people have also been killed in Palestinian retaliatory attacks against Israeli settlers during that time.
Iran has been invited to become a member of the BRICS group of emerging economies, whose leaders have attended a summit in Johannesburg, South Africa, to discuss the bloc's expansion. The South African President Cyril Ramaphosa announced on Thursday that the BRICS member states agreed to admit Iran to the bloc.
We have consensus on the first phase of this expansion process, and other phases will follow. We have decided to invite the Argentine Republic, the Arab Republic of Egypt, the Federal Democratic Republic of Ethiopia, the Islamic Republic of Iran, the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, and the United Arab Emirates to become full members of BRICS. The membership will take effect from the 1st of January 2024.
The five current member states have reached a consensus on the first phase of this expansion process. Reacting to the news, Mohammad Jamshidi, the Iranian president's deputy chief of staff for political affairs, said Iran's membership in BRICS is a historical development and a strategic success for the foreign policy of the Islamic Republic. Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi said Tehran seeks to promote cooperation with the member states of the BRICS group of emerging economies. He also noted that Iran, in its foreign policy, has put the promotion of relations with all independent countries in the world on its agenda.
And the benefits of Iran's membership to BRICS is going to make history and open a new chapter and a stronger step towards justice, fairness, ethics, and sustainable and lasting peace on the international stage.
The Chinese President Xi Jinping has said the expansion of BRICS will inject new impetus to the group's cooperation mechanism. This expansion has reflected BRICS' determination for unity and cooperation. He said this membership expansion is historic. The expansion is also a new starting point for BRICS cooperation. It will bring new vigor to the BRICS cooperation mechanism and further strengthen the force for world peace and development. Russia has also welcomed Iran's application and the group's expansion to include international powerhouses. Meanwhile, South Africa's foreign minister has said that leaders of the BRICS bloc have agreed on mechanisms for considering new members, giving dozens of interested nations a path into the organization. The inclusion of Saudi Arabia, the UAE, Iran, and Egypt marks the first MENA representation in the group, and the inclusion of Argentina was championed by member Brazil. The expansion of the group is part of its plan to build dominance and to reshape global governance into a multipolar world order.
Excellencies,
We are moving towards a multipolar world, and that is a positive thing. But multipolarity in itself is not enough to guarantee a peaceful or just global community. To be a factor of peace, equity, and justice in international relations, multipolarity must be supported by strong and effective multilateral institutions.
UAE President Mohammed bin Zayed said he appreciated the inclusion of his country as a new member of the important group. We respect the vision of BRICS leadership and appreciate the inclusion of the UAE as a member to this important group. We look forward to a continued commitment of cooperation for the prosperity, dignity, and benefit of all nations and people around the world. The bloc's expansion raises the question of potential de-dollarization, process by which members would gradually switch to using currencies other than the U.S. dollar to conduct trade. The expansion also takes place at a time when some BRICS members, namely Russia and China, are locked into rising tensions with the West. Experts believe that choosing to include countries like Iran, have opted to choose a foreign policy independent of the West, could swing the group further toward becoming an anti-Western bloc. BRICS held its first summit in 2009 with four members and then added South Africa the following year. It launched its new development bank in 2015. More than 40 countries have expressed interest in joining BRICS, and 23 formally applied to join the club, which already represented a quarter of the global economy and 40% of the world's population.
Has reportedly begun unloading cargo from a seized tanker which is believed to have been transporting Iranian oil to Singapore. Suez Rajan, the oil tanker, has sat off the coast of Texas since May. Last week, a group of American lawmakers implored the Biden administration to end the impasse and offload the tanker. Ship tracking data analyzed by American news agency The Associated Press showed the oil tanker started ship-to-ship transfer of its cargo to another tanker, the MR Euphrates, some 70 kilometers southeast of Houston. The cargo aboard that vessel is estimated to be 800,000 barrels of oil, with an estimated value of $56 million. The spokesperson for the Iranian Foreign Ministry declined to confirm the report but warned the U.S. that his country won't remain silent on the violation of its rights. Nasser Kanani slammed the measures that involved attacking oil tankers carrying Iranian oil as a brazen example of piracy. He said the general principle is that the era of hit and run has been over. The spokesman emphasized that the Islamic Republic won't remain silent on any violation of the Iranian nation's rights, will show an appropriate reaction, and cut off the hands of violators. Already, Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps, the IRGC, has warned that those involved in offloading the Suez Rajan's cargo should expect to be struck back. The IRGC's Navy commander, Rear Admiral Ali Reza Tangsiri, warned that Iran would hold any oil company seeking to unload its crude from the vessel responsible. He said Iran would also hold America responsible. Washington has claimed to have hijacked tankers carrying Iranian oil several times, arguing that the ships had been flouting U.S. sanctions. The U.S. usually auctions off Iran's stolen assets, claiming it would use the money to pay damages to alleged victims of the Islamic Republic's actions. Meanwhile, Washington plans to sell the confiscated Iranian oil and use the money for the victims and survivors of the 9/11 al-Qaeda attacks. Tehran accuses the U.S. of stealing its oil, saying the move is illegal. Iran has warned against the provocative buildup of American forces in the Persian Gulf, saying the move comes at a time when regional countries are improving their relations. Tehran says the security of the region, especially that of the Persian Gulf waterway, must be ensured within the region itself by the Persian Gulf states. In this regard, Iran, Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, and Oman are to form a joint naval force under China's auspices towards enhancing maritime security in the Persian Gulf and the Strait of Hormuz. The Strait of Hormuz is a key strategic strip of water between the Persian Gulf and the Gulf of Oman, where near a third of the world's oil flows through. Back in July, the U.S. military announced it has deployed 3,000 sailors and marine forces to West Asia under the pretext of protecting ships and vessels crossing the main waterways in the region. A recently released footage from Iran showed an encounter on August 17th involving the USS Bataan and USS Thomas Hutner. The video footage released by the naval force of Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps, the IRGC, showed Iranian speedboats issuing warnings to a U.S. helicopter carrier in the Strait of Hormuz, forcing the warship to ground its choppers before they can enter Iran's territorial waters. The commander of the IRGC Navy, Rear Admiral Alireza Tangsidi, said his forces' success in monitoring maritime movements in the Persian Gulf and their vigilance in the face of threats, particularly from the warships of extra-regional countries, proved that the Iranian forces would never allow enemies to undermine security in this strategic region. Iran has made it clear that it views U.S. military vessels lurking in the waters of the Persian Gulf as a threat to its national security and a source of tension and instability in the region. The Islamic Republic has repeatedly vowed to give a decisive response to any hostile move by Washington that would disrupt the security of the strategic waterway.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The BRICS combined GDP already exceeds that of the G7, and the gap will widen further once 6 new members join next year. Regarding this issue, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. RT wrote, the addition of 6 new member states will propel the BRICS group of countries far ahead of its major rival, the G7, in economic terms. Several Russian media outlets reported recently citing calculations based on global data. BRICS currently consists of Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa, but next January it will admit Iran, Argentina, Egypt, Ethiopia, Saudi Arabia, and the UAE. According to reports from the news outlets RBK and TASS, the combined gross domestic product GDP of the expanded BRICS in terms of purchasing power parity, that is PPP, will be roughly $65 trillion. This would see the bloc's share of global GDP rise from the current 31.5% to 37%. In comparison, the share of the G7 group of advanced economies is currently around 29.9%. Furthermore, with the addition of the new members, BRICS nations will account for almost half of the world's food production. In 2021, the group's wheat harvest amounted to 49% of the globe's total. The share of the G7 was 19.1%. BRICS will also have an advantage in terms of the production of metals used in the high-tech industry. The 11 nations will account for 79% of global aluminum output against just 1.3% controlled by the G7.
For palladium, the disparity is 77% for BRICS versus 6.9% for the G7. The expanded BRICS will account for roughly 38.3% of the globe's industrial production versus 30.5% for the G7. However, the latter will retain the advantage in terms of exports, with a share of 28.8% against 23.4% for BRICS. Saudi Arabia has the largest economy among the new BRICS member states. Its GDP in dollar terms at the end of 2022 was estimated at $1.1 trillion. Meanwhile, the UAE will be a formidable addition to the bloc thanks to its status as a major exporter. Its exports of goods in 2022 amounted to nearly $600 billion. Overall, the 11 BRICS countries will account for 48.5 million square kilometers, representing 36% of the world's land area. This is more than double that of the G7. The combined population will amount to 3.6 billion, 45% of the globe's total, and more than four times above the G7. NBC News also noted, as China and Russia work to curtail American and Western influence on the global stage, the bloc of developing countries known as BRICS is debating a major expansion to increase its power and diminish the dominance of the US dollar. Already, the five members of BRICS collectively make up some 40% of the global population and more than 30% of the global economy, according to the International Monetary Fund. As it fashions itself into an alternative to the US-dominated G7 and other Western-led international groupings, BRICS has become a major platform for developing nations in the global south that have long complained they have been left behind. Aiming to expand their economic options, BRICS members have also discussed creating a currency that could offer an alternative to the US dollar for global trade, a push known as de-dollarization. According to Tasnim News Agency, the BRICS consortium is set to reshape the global energy landscape as per calculations based on 2022 OPEC data on oil production and exports, reported InfoTech news outlets recently. According to these computations, the group's projected expansion involving the addition of six new members will grant it dominion over nearly half of the world's oil reserves and production. Currently comprised of Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa, BRICS announced at the Johannesburg summit that Iran, Argentina, Egypt, Ethiopia, Saudi Arabia, and the UAE will officially join in January 2024. With the inclusion of Iran, Saudi Arabia, UAE, the group will significantly increase its weight in the oil market. Together with current members, Russia and Brazil, these nations collectively control 39% of the world's total oil exports, equivalent to 17.1 million barrels per day. After expansion, the 11 nations in BRICS will account for approximately 47.6% of the world's total oil production, according to the data. Regarding oil reserves, BRICS will also possess nearly half of the world's total. amounting to 719.5 billion barrels out of 1.6 trillion. If Venezuela, which has applied for membership, is accepted, the group's control will increase to around 65.4%. In comparison, the G7 leading economies, including the US, the UK, Germany, Italy, Canada, France, and Japan, control only 3.9% of known crude reserves. Analysts anticipate that BRICS expansion to include Persian Gulf countries will likely diminish U.S. influence in the global oil market. Irish economist Philip Plington, in an article for the British Portrait Unheard, said, Saudi Arabia and the UAE joining is extremely significant. The United States used to rely on the Persian Gulf monarchies, especially Saudi Arabia, to exert control over the oil price. With their accession to BRICS, it seems likely that America has lost any control it had over oil prices for the foreseeable future. Pillington also noted that the recent BRICS summit signifies the end of Iran's economic isolation. Given Iran's status as the world's eighth largest oil producer with the third largest proven oil reserves.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is the part of the speech delivered by the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, on August 6, 2023, with a meeting with the commanders, crew, and families of the 86th flotilla of the Islamic Republic of Iran's Navy. Security for shipping and maritime transport must be ensured for all countries. Today, the U.S. attacks all tankers and helps maritime smugglers. What they are doing is a major violation. They do this in our region, and we are aware that they are doing this more or less in other places as well. These are violations of an international human law that cannot be disregarded. You practically implemented this law of public safety on the sea for everyone. This is another lesson. A conclusion can be made from all the lessons I have mentioned and from all the things I have said about the endeavor, and that is that we should all know that human success, great achievements, diverse developments, and fulfilled hopes are all the result of efforts and enduring hardships. Nothing is gained by seeking one's own comfort, by sitting in a corner, by just watching things, by regretting, by sighing, or by complaining. You must endure hardships.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today. And that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
You need to struggle and work hard in order to succeed. It is not enough to look at the peak of the mountain that someone else has climbed and say, I want to be there as well. If you want to get there, you need to endure the discomfort of moving on this path, or you won't get there. You have proven this. This is another important lesson. Now, I would like to mention two other brief points at the end of my speech. One point is that the story of your 8-month journey can be a source for a good television or movie project. Artists need to come forward. What happened to you during this period is not something that can fit in a report of a few pages or in a speech of a few minutes. Every detail of what you experienced needs to be noted. There were 350 of you. Each of you had feelings, did things, had certain thoughts, did certain things, and experienced moments of happiness and moments of sadness. All of these things together can form a long, informative, meaningful story. This story can be presented in artistic form, in a cinematic or televised form. It is up to the artist to do this. The final point, which concerns the country's officials, is paying attention to the sea. We are still not paying enough attention to the sea.
I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
Amid widespread anger over the disturbing trend of Quran desecrations across Scandinavia, the Danish government has announced plans to criminalise public mistreatment of religious objects. The new laws would permit police to act if holy scriptures, including the Quran, the Bible or the Torah, are physically violated.
The Danish authorities' promise to change the law has been well received by many Muslim onlookers. However, there is still a lot of concern surrounding the reasons behind why this decision may be implemented. The idea that Denmark is facing a major threat from the Muslim world, rather than, for example, admitting that their freedom of speech argument is flawed, that is in itself suspect and could even be an indication or a message to the Muslim world that Denmark is not willing to adopt any responsibility for the vile desecrations and offence that have been caused. Rather, they're seeking to place blame once again on the Muslim community itself for the reasons behind this law change.
On Saturday, local Danish Muslims gathered in a show of strength to continue the pressure in hopes of the law change proposal becoming a reality. Danish coalition officials said they could enact the policy as soon as the end of the year if it is approved by Parliament. According to a draft of a bill published by the Danish Justice Ministry, those found guilty of mistreating an object with major religious significance could be fined or sentenced to up to 2 years in prison. Both Denmark and neighbouring Sweden have struggled to defend the West's free speech argument, finally wilting in the face of international condemnations. The Quran desecrations infuriated the Muslim world, sparking massive protests across the globe. Rather than owning up or apologising for their defence of hate speech, Denmark's leaders have said that the national security was the primary motivation for the ban. This was the excuse they've used for the law change. While some Muslims have been left disappointed with this reasoning, some celebrate the development as a victory in the war against Islamophobic hate speech. Robert Carter, Copenhagen.
Cesium-137, Iran's new solution for radioactive waste management and a leap forward in nuclear medicine, not to mention its many applications in industrial gauges. The Atomic Energy Organization of Iran made the announcement while unveiling the homegrown radioisotope, which is currently produced at laboratory scales.